This is Weekend Edition on WNYC. Good morning. I'm David First. Tuesday is Election Day, the culmination of what has been an unprecedented political season in America. So on a special edition of WNYC's This Week in Politics, we look back on our coverage from the past year to explore how this historic race has evolved and what we have learned. We bring together now some of the reporters from our newsroom who've been covering this election since, I guess, since 2012 or so. Senior editor for Politics and Policy, Andrea Bernstein, who has reported on Hillary Clinton for many years. Matt Katz, who has been covering Governor Christie for over 5 years and covered so many aspects of the 2016 race. And Janet Babin, who has been covering Donald Trump through this election year. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks, David.
So I know everyone here picked a Clinton-Trump matchup back in 2014, so congrats on that. This election, obviously, has been unlike anything we've seen. There's been so much coverage. If you could pull yourself out of the day-to-day reporting for a moment, what have we learned this past year? Janet, what stands out for you?
Well, I think back, David, to when we first encountered Trump in front of a crowd during the debates when he would be debating with his Republican challengers. And the way Trump talked on those dais was a bit shocking.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't.
We hear him talking about his foes in this way that's quite shocking. But as we, as New Yorkers, know Donald Trump, we go back decades to him really talking about his enemies in a way that's quite ugly. And I'm thinking back now to the way he talked about a New York City councilwoman, Ronnie Eldridge, back in the early 90s. She was opposing him on this real estate project he wanted to get off the ground on the West Side, Riverside South. And instead of attacking her issues, he attacks her personally.
Ronnie Eldridge doesn't know what she's talking about. Ronnie Eldridge is second rate in just about every way. She's fought unsuccessfully to try and stop this. And, you know, she's just a woman that doesn't have a great grasp of finance or anything else.
And, of course, we've heard so much this year about the way he talks about women, the way he treats women, and the hot mic video comes out where we hear Donald Trump casually bragging about assaulting women with Billy Bush.
And I think, David, that when I spoke to women all throughout the year about Trump's comments, even many Republican women from the Upper East Side I interviewed had serious concerns about the way he talked about women. And then, as you said, when that video came out, my first instinct was, oh, I've got to talk to men. I've got to go interview men at a barbershop or something and see what do they think of these comments that Trump is making about the way he's talking about women. I had to say, wait a second. Why don't I go and find out what women are thinking about the way Trump is portraying us?
And Janet, you just mentioned something there. You had to think about what to do when you heard that comment. Is that something that you all felt during this election of, how do I approach this? How do I cover this? Andrea?
Constantly.
Yes.
I mean, I think that that's been the story of this election, that just on a sort of a personal level, if you'd told me in April 2015 when this campaign started that the things that I've been called in this election, Jewess, whore, slut, that I've had yellow stars tweeted at me, all of that, I just wouldn't have believed. And what is so amazing is that that's unremarkable. That is now the ordinary discourse. We only notice when a reporter has her photo with a bullet hole in her head tweeted out, and all the rest of it has become so normalized. And, you know, I have been asking since the beginning of this campaign, how do we cover a candidate who openly says that he wants to start tearing apart the First Amendment?
I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money.
Just starting with that, I mean, we have you know, sort of obviously an institutional interest in perpetrating the First Amendment. So it's a different set of questions than I've ever faced.
Yeah, I was not expecting this election to be centered so overtly on identity, this anxiety over the loss of white identity, millions of anti-Semitic tweets from Trump supporters that have flown out there on the internet, including a couple that Andrew and I have received. Black versus white fights at rallies. I thought this election would have, you know, the subtle dog whistles that Republican campaigns have had for 40 years, where they reach out to white voters by sometimes playing to their more base instincts about race. But instead, Donald Trump began this campaign by saying most Mexicans are rapists.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
And then he cemented his victory when he said that all Muslims should be banned from the country. And then in a general election, he described all African Americans as living in terrible conditions and only he can save them. That was then followed up by endorsements from elements of the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacist websites. So this has not been a dog whistle. It has been a scream from the right about race in ways that are deeply unsettling and that might not end after Election Day on Tuesday. Over the summer, I did a story on one consequence of this bigotry. This is the role that anti-Semitism has played in the race and the toll it has taken on journalists and political commentators.
Here's a quick clip from that piece.
I arrive at nap time at Bethany Mandel's second floor apartment in central New Jersey. Evidence of her two children under three, toys, toys, and more toys, is everywhere.
Are the kids sleeping?
Yes.
Awesome.
She's a full-time mom who works from home, and that's why her laptop, open, is on the couch. But that's not what I came to see.
Can I see the gun?
Sure, I have to go get it.
She retrieves a purple box from the bedroom and lays it between us.
It's a .22 revolver. It's not loaded, obviously.
Mandel, 30 years old, is a politically conservative writer and an Orthodox Jew who has written in prominent Jewish and conservative publications about her opposition to Trump. That's why she had to buy a gun.
The Trump campaign has been mostly silent on this stuff. Trump famously was delayed, to put it politely, in refuting support from David Duke, the former Klan leader. And that has been a takeaway from this campaign that I frankly wish I didn't have to take away.
Matt, back in early May, the primary was still going on. Donald Trump had just become, at that point, the presumptive GOP nominee. Lots of pundits were looking ahead to the summer and wondering, you know, how is this guy going to pivot? And then he went off on this tangent, repeating an unsubstantiated story from the National Enquirer, suggesting that Ted Cruz's father was conspiring with Lee Harvey Oswald.
All I did is point out the fact that on the cover of the National Enquirer, there was a picture of him and crazy Lee Harvey Oswald having breakfast.
What did this moment tell you about 2016?
It told me that this whole election was going to be about conspiracy theories, Clinton conspiracy theories dredged up from 25 years ago up till today. It was going to be about unfounded allegations and rumors, and that is certainly what it's been about. We've seen rape t-shirts with Bill Clinton's face on it, dolls of Hillary and a noose because she's a criminal and a murderer. This is a presidential campaign from Donald Trump that is based on conspiracy theories, from the fact that he has pushed policies based on the falsehood that Syrian refugees are terrorists, to Hillary Clinton deserving to be in prison, even though she hasn't been charged with anything. I knew this was going to be a campaign based on conspiracy theories because he associates with conspiracy theorists, from Roger Stone, his longtime dark arts political operative and friend, to Alex Jones, a new friend of his, whose InfoWars website is just conspiratorial nonsense. And Alex Jones says 9/11 was an inside job. Donald Trump goes on this guy's show. All the conspiracy theories really culminate into this allegation that the election is rigged, something that Trump has convinced, according to one poll I saw, most Republicans of, even though there's no evidence of this. To that end, I'll be in Philadelphia to see if there's voter fraud on Tuesday. I spoke to an election official, though, there last week, and he said they're confident that nothing untoward is going to happen and there'll be no conflict on the streets.
Andrea Bernstein, is that the theme for you? This is the election of the conspiracy theory?
Well, not exactly. I mean, I think that, you know, I have complicated feelings about that because obviously that's what's getting discussed. I feel what is motivating voters are still issues I saw at the beginning of this campaign: income inequality, race relations, who we are as Americans now. But in some ways, this election isn't so different from the very first Hillary Clinton campaign that I covered, which was when she ran for Senate in 2000. And that campaign started on the heels of her husband's impeachment and the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And so people were already talking about that and all of the Bill Clinton scandals. And she was relentlessly attacked on that during that campaign, starting with her being a carpetbagger. By the time we got to this time, in October of 2000, she was charged with colluding with terrorists who'd bombed U.S. troops in Yemen. That backfired. She won by a bigger margin than anybody expected. So all of this, in some ways, was played out on a miniature scale in 2000 when she first ran. But even so, if you had told me in April of 2015, when that campaign started, that the level of hatred for Hillary Clinton would be this deep, I never would have believed it. I mean, I have certainly had my own frustrations covering Hillary Clinton over the years, but I have noticed a trend, which is that people who meet her firsthand are surprised by how much they like her, how much she connects. So here's an excerpt from a story we ran this year that looked back as her time as senator from New York. I caught up with her in July 2006 in Lake Placid in the Adirondacks, population 2,500. Even in this generally politically ignored area of the state, Clinton had friends.
Hey, Cliff, how are you?
I'm good.
Yeah, nice to see you here.
Oh, good to see you. Oh.
How have you been?
I've been fine.
Good.
How have you been?
Excellent, excellent.
You did a good job.
Thank you,
good
thank
job.
You. Well, a lot of good things to talk about here.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know, I know. Well, and I'm hoping, you know, with the opening of the Wild Center tomorrow, we really just put a...
I think we'll be there. I think, you know, Joni and Aaron
good.
Will be
good.
There.
So.
There are 20 million people in New York, and somehow Clinton seems to be on a first-name basis with half of them.
That's a very different glimpse of Hillary Clinton than what the constant attacks this election year would have you believe. There are actually some people who like Hillary Clinton.
There are actually people who love Hillary Clinton, probably the least covered group in this election. And the national polls have also tracked that way. So during her convention and after the debates, when she got to talk to sustained way to Americans, her polling went up. When she talks through us, her polling numbers go down. So all of this has created a bit of a dilemma for me, because some of my fact-checking, some of my basic journalism has gone in the direction of, she's not as bad as you think, folks, which is kind of, you know, the opposite of what I'm usually doing, or at least saying, you know, what they are saying about themselves is false. My experience with her is, while she is very political, with all of the baggage that that carries and all the things that people don't like about politics in 2016, she is still part of ordinary politics that I have personally covered over and over among politicians of both parties. Part of why we know this is because she has disclosed so much, and so much has been unwillingly released about her, versus her opponent, who's never released his tax returns, who jokes about assaulting women, who lies three-quarters of the time, according to PolitiFact. That is not ordinary politics. So when I see these headlines about how voters hate both candidates equally, I never would have predicted that.
How much of the vitriol that you're talking about do you think is caused by the simple fact that Hillary Clinton is a woman?
You know, I just saw a new poll out, an Iowa poll, that said 20% of all voters and 40% of Republicans say the country is not ready for a woman president. So at least that's honest. The open misogyny in this campaign has been stunning, starting with the way Trump talks about Clinton, what Janet was saying about how he's talked about women When people say there's something I don't like about her or I just can't imagine her being president, you have to attribute some of that to bias, even if it's so unconscious people don't recognize. And I see it even among women. It's not a men-women thing. One of the things that I will be looking for as we get close to Election Day, because I think one of the things that's been eclipsed as we get close to Election Day is the fact that if she wins, she would be the first woman president. And I already saw during the primary season when she won the primaries, the emotion that generated. If she wins, there is going to be emotion unleashed around that. And if she loses, there will be emotion released.
WNYC's Janet Babin, Matt Katz, and Andrea Bernstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.